For a long time now, I've been trying to tap into, eavesdrop, I suppose you could say, on some conversations about everyday life on the streets of China. What are people talking about? What are their water cooler topics? As outsiders, we get so caught up in the broader political and economic decision making that you might think to yourself, what are the Chinese talking about as friends, privately, as families? What keeps them awake at night? Well, I haven't been that successful in finding someone who can talk openly from China. So when I read a review of a book called Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road, I knew I'd found someone with the same idea. Rob Schmitz is a China correspondent for National Public Radio. It's the closest outlet, really, to RN in the US. He lives on the officially named Street of Eternal Happiness with his family, and he's collected stories from some of the local Chinese who live and work on his street. He's captured their dreams and aspirations as well, as you'll hear, and how they came to live on one of the busiest streets in the centre of Shanghai. He first made a podcast series of these conversations and turned it into a truly insightful book detailing the challenges and tensions of everyday life in 21st century China.
Good morning, Geraldine. Thanks for having me.
It's such a clever idea, Rob. And you speak the language, Mandarin. And do you just speak Shanghainese, by the way, or Mandarin primarily?
Unfortunately, I do not speak Shanghainese. Right. My son is picking it up at school, but not me. But yeah, I speak Mandarin.
Tell us about, firstly, your time in China, because you went there first as a Peace Corps volunteer, didn't you, in 1996?
Yeah, in 96, I had just graduated from college, and I wanted to go to South America because my major was Spanish, but the U.S. government, which runs the Peace Corps, they decided that I should go to China, and so they sent me to,
off to China.
Rural, yeah, to hell with your Spanish language. So I spoke no Chinese, and they sent me to rural southwest China, Sichuan province. At the time, this was a province that had not had much foreign interaction, and the city where I lived, I was myself and two site mates, we were the first foreign residents in the city since before 1949.
My goodness.
Before the revolution.
What an experience.
So every day was like living the life of a space alien walking through a Chinese town. We would attract onlookers. People would follow us around. It was an event every time I left my apartment.
Let's talk about the Street of Eternal Happiness. What a great name. Tell us about the geography, if you would, please, and the history and the English plane trees planted there.
The Street of Eternal Happiness is actually the rough translation of the street. The street's Chinese name is Changle Lu. If you take it literally, it means Long Happiness Street. And it's a street that runs through the heart of Shanghai. And it is on the northern fringe of a neighborhood that was established by the French when Shanghai had been divided up by the foreign powers in the 19th century after the Opium Wars. So the French had taken this plot of land that was at that time outside the city limits and developed it and made it to look like Paris. And so every 15 feet or so, they planted these London plane trees, which at that time in the 19th century were being used because they were great urban trees. And so they planted these trees all over their streets. And it really gives that neighborhood a distinctive look because the way that they prune these trees make it so that the trees start growing outwards. They prune them very, very closely around the second story level. And so you've got this effect when you walk down a street in the French Concession in Shanghai of walking underneath a green tunnel of leaves that protects you from the really hot sun at this time of the year in the summer and also the big storms that kind of rumble through.
So, I mean, they've survived the Japanese bombing Shanghai. They've survived Mao revolutions. You write about this class warfare, the untimely death of millions. It's now a capitalist, well, it's a very interesting hybrid, of course, but it's lined with restaurants, shops. And the trees have seen it all, haven't they?
The trees have been the residents of Shanghai that have stuck around. They've seen a lot of change. They've seen revolution. They've seen bombings. They've seen communism and Maoism. And now they're seeing the probably one of the largest cities on the planet that's growing the fastest of any city on the planet.
What I've found that weaves through the various people you've written about, whom you've come to know so well, is the contrast between what the individuals wanted or want for their lives and their children, and how the state, via its various goals for the country, have imposed upon them and altered their lives and their aspirations. Very much that sense of the individual, not just versus the system, just copying fatalistically, sort of, the system, quotes.
Yeah, and this is part of the reason why I wanted to write this book, is that I got to know my neighbors really, really well, and I felt like I had this great material that could fit into a book. And one of the reoccurring themes that I kept seeing in everyone's lives as I interviewed them was that they all ran up against this system. And this system is not only the political system of China and the Communist Party, but it's also a societal system of China, a cultural system, if you will. This is the system that has parents place very, very high expectations on their only children oftentimes. It is a system that dictates that family is the most important and everything you do should serve your parents. So there are a lot of pressures on everyday Chinese right now. And these pressures are obstacles in many of their lives to achieve their new dreams, because we are in an era right now in China where a lot of people, especially in Shanghai, have reached this first dream of attaining wealth. You know, for about 20 or 30 years in China, the one big dream was to make money, right? To increase your personal GDP growth as well as the national GDP growth for the state. Everyone was on the same page. But now we've reached a point where a lot of people have achieved that dream, especially in Shanghai, and they're looking for other dreams. They're looking for dreams like spirituality, religion. They're looking for dreams like equality. You know, for example, Zhao Shiling, who is one of the characters in my book, she owns a flower shop.
I'm just about to raise her.
Yeah. Yeah. So she, her dream is a dream of, in many ways, of equality. She comes from a rural part of China. It's a very poor part of China, a coal mining village. She was treated very poorly by her parents, as well as her husband, who beat her routinely. They had two boys, and once she finished having children, she left for Shanghai to work at a factory. And she worked very hard. She made a lot of money, and she saved it, and she started her own flower shop, a really tiny shop at the end of the street. And with this shop, she started making even more money. And she brought her eldest son to Shanghai from the coal mining village when he was very young. And he attended elementary school in Shanghai. He attended middle school in Shanghai. He basically grew up there. He was a great student, did very well in school, was the number one student in his class every year, and won a national essay writing competition. This kid was on track to be going to an elite university in China. But because he is not from Shanghai, the rules in China state that if you're not from the city that you were born or your ancestors grew up in, if you want to go to college, you have to attend high school in your ancestral village. Those are known as the hukou laws. It's basically an internal passport system that requires people to return home if they want to go to high school and go to college or get health care that's pretty specialized. And so he had to go home. And he failed. He did very poorly because the curriculum was completely different. He didn't really know this town that he supposedly grew up in. He was a city kid by then, and psychologically he was defeated. And he dropped out of high school and returned to Shanghai as a dropout and as a migrant worker, just like his mother. Had China not had that system, it's very likely that he would have gone to one of the best universities in China and would be making far more than he's making now. But because of the hukou registration system in China, people are truly not equal.
Well, quite. And, you know, just as we're coping with his story, Zhao's youngest son, little son, became one of the left behind children. I find his story almost sort of too hard to hear. You must tell us about
it. Yeah, and his story is even more tragic, because this is a son who didn't show that much promise for academics early on. And so Zhao decided not to take him to Shanghai. She left him at home. And, you know, at the time, China had been, you know, was growing very, very quickly, of course. And so the father, who was supposed to be taking care of the son, was working double shifts at the coal mine, was not home a lot. And the son, he became very isolated and stopped talking altogether, to the point where his teacher thought he was autistic. He was not. But the teacher declared that this child was autistic, and so they had to send him to an autistic school in the county. And so this ended up being obviously a huge problem. And he stopped talking to his mother because he took a lot of it out on her. And so she felt a lot of guilt because of that. And so I talk a lot about that story as well.
Well, you go on, you know, just here in page 52, the doctors began to recognize big psychological problems among the children like little son. According to one study, half suffered from depression and anxiety disorders. And the state media estimated there were 61 million. We've reported on this before, but the numbers are just so staggering. 61 million left behind boys and girls, one out of every five children in China.
Yeah, and these are kids who will not have a shot at becoming consumers in China. They, like you mentioned, many of them have psychological problems from being left behind.
And why wouldn't they?
No one to take care of them. And why wouldn't they? Exactly. And so this is a major problem that China is facing right now. And this is all because of this hukou system that exists in China. And when you speak to Chinese, just on the street, my street, about what are the biggest problems that China faces, it's not democracy, it's not internet censorship, it's not a lot of these things that we hear about China that are so awful in China, it's not pollution, it is hukou. That is one of the biggest problems that you'll always hear people complain about. It's a system that really creates an underclass that isn't so dissimilar from apartheid in South Africa.
It's like an internal passport system, isn't it, really?
It is, and people feel like and are treated like they are illegal immigrants inside their own country.
Can we go to CK, which is another extraordinary story? He's in his 30s now. He's taken control of his adult life. You met him on your street, and you say he was 11 years old when it dawned on him killing himself wasn't going to be easy. Mercifully, he didn't do that.
Yeah.
He still has dreams. He broke away from the system that his father used to rant to him about. But I find the CK story also extraordinary.
Yeah, CK is one of my most inspiring friends on the street. He came also, like Zhao, he came from a very poor city and he worked very hard. He had a miserable background. As you mentioned, he attempted suicide when he was just 11 years old after his parents divorced. His father abused him, but he worked hard and he learned to play the accordion very, very well. So well that he was given a scholarship to go to a major university in a very big city in southern China, Guangzhou. And he did very well at college. And after he graduated, he worked at a state-owned enterprise, which was a dream of his parents, that he work at a state-run company. Because if you, at the time, worked at a state-run company, you could have great benefits, your great pension, health care. It was the Iron Rice Bowl, as it was known as. But CK is a very curious individual, and he wants to learn. But at an SOE, at a state-owned enterprise in China, it's not a place where you're going to learn new things. It's a place where you sit around oftentimes, and you know this is the waste in the Chinese economy in many ways. And he didn't like the atmosphere there, and so he quit. And his father and mother were livid about it. And he moved to Shanghai with a dream, and his dream was to find a job that where he had more control and where he could learn something. He was hired by an Italian accordion maker. This engineer from Italy who had previously worked at Ferrari and now was making accordions for a big company called Polverini. And so he hired CK and taught him how to assemble and disassemble an accordion, which is a pretty complex machine. And he worked his way up and became the sales manager and one of the vice presidents of the company here in China and did very well and made a lot of money, so much money where he decided that he would go off on his own and start his own sandwich shop, which is across the street from where I live. Unfortunately, his business sense is not as good as his engineering sense, and he made a pretty fatal error when he founded this sandwich shop. The sandwich shop happens to be on the second floor, and if you're in Shanghai, the problem with that is that the trees that I was talking about before happen to obscure the entire shop. No one can see it from the ground level, so nobody ever came into his sandwich shop. And later on, CK, much like a lot of young people, restless young people his age who are intellectually curious, becomes very spiritual. Right now, more and more young people throughout China are turning to religion to look for answers. CK is one of them. He became Buddhist, and he found a master out in the countryside who he followed. And to this day, he's incredibly religious. And we're seeing that in many ways, it's a religious renaissance happening right now in China.
Where is it taking him, and how does the system view this?
Yeah, and then that's a great question. The system, or the Communist Party, I think, sees religion in a couple of ways. It's a complicated relationship. Religion is obviously totally legal in China. It is under the constitution. The rights of religion are guaranteed under the constitution of China. However, there are certain religions like Christianity that the current leader see as a foreign religion and almost see as a threat.
The huge rebellions, as you know, in the 19th century, the Boxer Tianjin Rebellion, have been sponsored by belief, and it's got way out of control. So they've got legitimate fears.
They do. And it's a religion that I think traditionally, has seen a lot of suspicion towards it. On the other hand, Christianity is the fastest growing religion in China right now. More and more young people are turning to Christianity. They're going to church, whether they're legal or not. And I've seen predictions by sociologists in China that say by 2030, at the current pace of converts to Christianity, China will be the largest Christian nation on the planet.
My goodness.
So these are things that the party, I think, are very nervous about and is seen with a lot of suspicion.
Rob, I think we'll have to invite you back. There's too much more to talk about. But that's enough for today. It's certainly a very different perspective on China to the one that we generally get in our headlines. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Geraldine. I appreciate it.
That's the radio journalist Rob Schmitz, and he's the China correspondent for NPR, and his book Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road, is published by John Murray. It's part of Hachette, and we'll put a link up to Rob's pod series, by the way, too, which this book is based upon.